Before we get started, you gotta know about 99 Designs because it's the largest crowdsourced marketplace for graphic design. When I used them, I wrote a description of the design I needed and how much I was willing to pay. I got back a bunch of designs. I gave each designer feedback, and then I got a batch of new designs back. I only picked the design that I liked and paid just for that. Try them for logo design, for blog design, for app icons, and so much more. 99designs.com. Grasshopper is the virtual phone system that I use. It lets me add extensions and change my greeting and forward my calls and so much more. I even have a toll-free number from them. Try it for yourself at grasshopper.com. And finally, I have a brand new sponsor, PicClick. It was launched by an entrepreneur that you're going to admire because PicClick is bootstrapped and profitable. Previously, the founder created a visual way to search Craigslist, but then Craigslist banned him. Instead of calling it quits, he launched PicClick, a visual way to search eBay, Etsy, Plenty of Fish, and other sites. I want you to check out his website and tell me why you think it's profitable. And support the scrappy founder because he has a good business. PicClick, P-I-C-C-L-I-C-K, P-I-C-C-L-I-C-K.com. Here's the program. Hey everyone, I'm Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. You guys know what we do here every day, every single weekday. I think I've been doing this now every weekday since last 8 months at least. I bring on a different entrepreneur to talk about how he built his business or how she grew her company. We talk to entrepreneurs about their big successes. We talk about their big failures, and we learn from everything that they've experienced so that we don't have to experience it firsthand to learn for ourselves. And more importantly, so we can go out there and build incredible businesses ourselves. Today, I've got Jim Lanzone with me. He is the founder of Clicker, the programming guide to TV. There he is. It makes finding online video very easy, incredibly easy. I just typed in a few people to prep for this interview, and then I got carried away and started looking at all their videos. Previously, he was CEO of Ask, and before that, he founded eTour. Welcome.
Thank you.
Jim, by the way, how do you do such a freaking good job? But I won't ask all these softball questions. We're going to talk about eTour. I've read lots of interviews. I saw the Jason Calacanis interview with you, and I plan to ask questions that others hadn't talked about, and you and I talked about how we'll be talking about eTour. But I've got to ask what seems like a softball question because I'm fascinated. How do you get all that content sorted and so easy to find, much better even than Google does?
Well, I guess two ways. So one is, I mean, we did spend a year in stealth building it, and it doesn't just happen. The thing is that there's so many videos, premium videos, you know, and that's all we index. We're not dealing in cat videos or excerpts or clips or illegal stuff. We're only categorizing the things, let's say, that are worthy of the 10-foot experience or that we would deem to be that. But even with that, that's still hundreds of thousands of episodes across thousands of sites. And so the way you can't do that manually. So from a technology standpoint, it's search. You know, we're search guys and the core team here comes from search. And so what we spent our time doing was kind of plugging all of our technology into these thousands of sites and doing it so that we could suck down all their data and then normalize it into one consistent data structure. Because if you go back to the beginning, I mean, our goal here was to build the TV guide of the next generation, and what we thought was that would look more, if you were starting it today, that would look a lot more like Yelp or IMDb or Wikipedia than it would a schedule grid, because it's no longer about when things are on, right? But the problem is that there was no metadata that existed yet. It wasn't like plugging in the shopping search where you could just say size 13 blue Nike running shoes, suck that down, it's all kind of already there. We had to go create it site by site. So the reason we're able to get all that data is because we set up technology to go suck it all down, and that's why even when things change, when you have a new episode, we know about it automatically. And then on the UI side, you know, I just think we've always, going back to Ask, had a very good UI team, and we take a lot of pride in that. We put a lot of effort into it. We care about it, which I think is half the battle sometimes. So hopefully it looks and feels, you know, very, very easy to use.
All right. I want to come back to this. We're going to go in chronological order, and I will come back to the UI because I love to find out how people improve their UI and how they even watch users interact with their website so they know what needs to be improved. Why don't we start with a website that I only read about in a New York Times article recently, something called NoX. That apparently was the gateway drug for you. What was that?
It was the gateway drug
for me. That's what got you into internet entrepreneurship.
Well, no, it was my first job, really. I mean, the short version of this is I went to UCLA. And, you know, as a kid growing up, my dad was a lawyer. My mom was a teacher. Our family business was a fish and chip store in Harlem. I mean, I'm not coming from a big lineage of people who were reading the Wall Street Journal here. And growing up, I had never done anything other than read the sports page and the entertainment section. And that pretty much existed all the way through college, where I was a river guide and I worked in a bookstore. I mean, I never really had a career track. And so I did what all people who don't know what they want to do. I went to law school. Very expensive and boring way to figure out what you don't want to do. So I got really lucky. I switched over to the business school, and one of the professors there hooked me up with a bunch of different internet startups. This was 96. One was Hotwired here in San Francisco, which created the first banner ad. One was Jam TV, which was the first, it became eMusic. And then the third was a company in Atlanta called Information America, which wasn't a real online business. It was kind of like LexisNexis. In fact, it had been bought by Westlaw, and they did public records. They sold them via, through online to lawyers and businesses and private investigators. And my first job there interning was build us a web version. Not just me. I mean, I was on a team of people who did it. But it just kind of clicked, and I spent, 8 months helping get that off the ground. And around the same time, two of my classmates at Emory Business School were starting a company, which became eTour, and they needed a product guy. And so I got cocky and said, sure, I could do that. And so I joined this startup in August of 97. Their name, by the way, for the corporate entity was JuxtaNet. Awesome name.
For eTour, right?
And it became eTour after we got funding. Yeah, so I joined the two of them and started helping them build that out.
I see. So we talked before the interview. Back then, you and I did business together. I think the first time that I met you was in Atlanta in your office. We used to send members to you. You used to send big, nice checks to us. It was a great relationship for a while.
Crazy days.
Those were the days. Here's what I haven't seen in the bios of you, and of your co-founder. I see sold to Ask Jeeves. I see raised over $50 million. In fact, the New York Times article said, we sold the company to AskJeeves.com by the skin of our teeth in 2001. But what no one says is, and this is a hard part for me to say because I want to make sure that you feel comfortable here being open and that you, I want to make sure that you feel comfortable. The company went bankrupt, right?
No, I mean, not technically. I mean, I think what a lot of companies in that period would happen was we didn't sell for as much as the company had raised, essentially. You know, the thing with eTour was that, the company did raise all this money. It was a top website. And the funny thing is we were one of those companies. Again, I was the product guy. I wasn't on the board or in any position to be making these decisions. But we, had these incredible offers for $400 million and $300 million. And it's just a great example of what was happening at that time, where our board was, this group of people who had already made a ton of money by going public or whatever. It was the founder of WebMD, the founder of IXL, which was like a big agency at the time. The founder of Relevant Knowledge, which became Media Metrics. So these guys had kind of hit it. And, the company decided not to pursue these options at the time in order to go public, which is a very, common thing in 2000.
Hell, and, I had on my Compilot back then. I had, I had on my Palm Pilot a list of all the people who were going to get friends and family shares when we went public. And here I was, an unfunded company, a guy from nowhere, and even I was thinking in that direction. So I completely get that.
Yeah, and so, I mean, the long story short is the market crashed. We didn't go public. We went on fumes until May of 01 until we sold it to Ask. And, you know, what we made on that deal, you know, was not going to cover everything that the company had spent on. So in order to build up to go public, it's really one really funny, interesting thing is that one of the models for kind of priming the pump to go public was Ask Jeeves. Like, I remember being in these meetings and people saying, you know, that we need to like buy Wall Street Journal ads. I mean, these things are expensive. And, you know, we were doing good revenue, I mean, but it was, you know, 8 to 10 million a year. It wasn't enough to really these days talk about like going public. And really, you know, buying these expensive ads. We did television ads, you probably remember this, and things, and that was all supposed to kind of like increase awareness before you went public. And then they're like, well, we'll go public at $500 million was the original price that we were supposed to go out at. So, you know, it's interesting from our beginnings, which was, as you said, we weren't funded. We were just three guys at a business school in Atlanta, and we actually had to prove ourselves. You know, we had, I think, 1.5 million. I mean, for people who don't know what eTour was, it was essentially StumbleUpon. The only real difference was that there was no such thing as social at the time on the web. And we had a team of editors essentially putting all the websites in the queue, but it was the same model that, you know, one of every X number of sites would be paid to be there. The sites would be matched to your interest, thumbs up, thumbs down, hit a next site button, you know.
It was a great model. I mean, you would say what your interests were. You'd see a big button on the bottom of the page, and you could just keep flipping through pages that match your interests, just like you said, just like StumbleUpon. The revenue came from those the pages that were sponsored, and you were sending traffic directly to the sponsors' website so that they can make so that they can use the full page to sell users on their service and to get them to understand what the product was, which is so much better than just a little banner ad.
Yeah, I mean, but it was definitely ahead of its time. And I would say, you know, I mean, what happened with eTour after we sold it was interesting, because Ask was in its own precarious position at the time. And we actually had to make a lot of choices. eTour was one of the things that we got rid of, along with a thing called AnswerPoint, which was, essentially Yahoo Answers 3 years before that. And we just killed it, too. But anyway, we didn't even raise our first dime for eTour until we were already the number one ranked site on the web in user loyalty. And, you know, we were already, and then all of a sudden the frothy market had taken off and people were throwing money at you. But, you know, it was a very cool site and a good idea and just early, you know.
But I thought that actually, you're right. It wasn't bankruptcy. There was something like bankruptcy, and we had to deal with lawyers in order to get our final payments. And we were told that if we pushed it, then we would be pushing the company into bankruptcy, and then the lawyers would get more of whatever cash was left in the bank than we would end up getting. And so,
I just think it didn't cover, you know, all the expenses that the company had laid out during that period, including things like, you know, advertising, and we did CPA deals with your company, Mailbits, and, you know, there are all kinds of things like we were getting 100,000 users from the island of Vanuatu through Mailbits, an island that only had 3,000 inhabitants. So we were wondering, you know, what was that? And there are all kinds of things that we could have gone into about that. But I think, you know, the thing is that the company had also done things like it bought a 10-year lease on a building in downtown Atlanta. You know, things that you just don't. This is beyond lean startup, and you know, this is same thing that you would have seen at 200 companies in San Francisco as well. So anyway, I mean, the at the end of the day, we were able to eTour had a very good reputation product wise at the time, and so Ask was one of multiple companies who wanted it. And so we wound up there. The interesting thing about that is that Ask was worth, I think the day we were acquired that month, was worth $30 million. It was a public company. It was worth $30 million. And even though it had $100 million in cash in the bank, so it was actually negatively valued from a market perspective. Most of the money at the same time, this is also, again, the kind of fog of war in the market, was being put into the software division of the company, which was a B2B kind of like prefabricated question answer product. Like if you were to go to Nike's site and you would type into their search box, you know, how can I return my shoes online, that it would already kind of have an answer for you. And that was like all the investment, most of the market cap. And the reason is because search didn't have a business model yet. And so, you know, the whole story of how Google happened has a lot to do with, I think, what all the search, quote unquote, search companies were doing at the time, which is that they were bastardizing their websites with 17 different forms of banner ads and all these things, trying to get profitable, not become delisted. And so this was still those days. And so that's why Ask killed off, I think, 8 different lines of businesses, including eTour was one of them, and our international businesses, things like that. So crazy, crazy crash period.
All right. I don't want to make you feel uncomfortable, so I'm not going to ask many more questions about eTour. If there's something that you feel you want to say about Mailbit, well, yeah, if there's something that you want to say about our relationship with it, I'm completely comfortable with it. You can say even the negative stuff. I want to be as open as you feel comfortable. And if there's anything that you remember about our experience, feel free to say it too.
I mean, I think the biggest problem at the time was, I mean, I guess this is just Wild West for everybody who was, you know, who was in existence then. And frankly, it's not even just the people who didn't make it. It's also the people who did make it and some of the missteps that they made at the time that they're still paying for. You know, Yahoo is a great example. And then, you know, shifting to becoming a portal, losing their brand as a search engine, kind of giving that business to Google, which, you know, then had a lot of implications down the road. I think one of the things happening at the time was people valuing companies based on the number of users, not based on revenue. But again, if you look back and think of the thousands of companies filing to go public versus the 3 in our space that do every year now, I mean, I think it's a very hard time to even gauge. If I look back, the biggest thing for me was just experience and knowing, hey, I know how to build really good stuff, and my team, you know, some of whom are still here, you know. We know how to build really good things. We know how to grow an audience, and so those lessons were important. But I'd say even some of the business lessons maybe don't even apply so much, just because of how crazy 99 to 2000 was, the 2-year period when, I mean, it was just insanity. I remember being at conferences where they would run a ticker on the wall of all the IPOs and all the public companies. I mean, everybody who would go on stage was public. And I don't know, it's funny. I keep waiting for someone to have cataloged that era in a really appropriate way. Maybe the best, what was that startup, the government startup in New York? I think they had a documentary about it.
Oh, startup.com or something was the name of the movie?
That may have been the best overview of what was really happening maybe at the time and what people were doing and thinking, but very interesting.
I'll tell you, I could never see that movie because it was too painful. Here's what happened to us. First of all, for a long time, companies were using us to go public in this way. We were able to generate registrations. All they cared about was number of registrations, because the market then would value them at a multiple of their registrations. So they might pay us $1, let's say, for a registration, but the market said every internet company is worth $20 times the number of registered users. So they'd pay us $1, they'd end up making the $19 difference by going public, and then they'd go public and, you know, the world would change for them. What happened to us, here's one of the mistakes that we made. I remember you guys coming into our office, and we had this dinky little office in Queens, New York, not even Manhattan. The first time that Roger, your co-founder, wanted to come see us, I was so embarrassed. I said, why don't we just meet at the airport? I'll make it easy for you. And so we met at the airport, and then the next time he insisted on seeing the office, so he came in. We showed you guys the office. I don't know if you were there with him or not, but I was so embarrassed. We quickly moved across the street to a Chinese place, which at the time I thought was more impressive. And now I look back, I go, what was I thinking? A Chinese restaurant in the middle of Queens? That's where I'm taking these guys?
You were a kid, right? I mean, it was probably your first job or one of them, right? I mean,
it was what do we know? Essentially, it was my first internet company. Soon after, my first company in general. Actually, no, before that, my kid brother and I tried a bunch of different things. Soon after, we did a 10-year lease on office space in Manhattan, just like you're talking about. 10 years, a full floor of space. Because there were no offices with internet access in them, we had to gut the whole office, rewire it so that we could have the internet that we needed, and then we were stuck with this office space that to this day I still have the lease on. I'm now subletting it.
Really?
So, yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. It's cool, except when it hurts.
Okay, yeah, but, so, you know, I mean, probably always well, why aren't you living there now?
In New York? I got burned out. I mean, we were just working nonstop. And then when the bubble burst was when I was ready to just take a break and go explore life. But the bubble burst and I had to stay on top of my business. And then when things finally leveled off, I said, I'm going to go and take some space. That's when I went to Los Angeles. I hung out for a bit. I had a good time. I put work behind me. I think that there are a lot of us who went through that period who were changed by it. For me, I was more open to non-work activities. For others, I noticed that they retreated from the internet and never were able to go. One of the things that I admired about you and a few others who were at that time and kept at it is that you kept at it. You didn't disappear the way that I did. You didn't take time off the way that I did. You stayed with Ask. You stayed on top of the industry. You grew and you grew and you grew until you became the CEO of Ask, which was part of IAC, a publicly traded company. Did you at any point feel like, I gotta get out of here, I gotta get a freaking break? I was running this one company, the bubble burst, I'm now here and now then. Did you ever feel that?
No, and I'll tell you that I wish I had, first of all. Not then. One interesting thing for me is I had taken a year off between college and law school.
Okay.
And I went and lived in Barcelona. And just, you know, you're railed, and I had a year off where I kind of did all that. But then, and then the first day of law school, I met my wife, my eventual wife. And so when E-Tour went to Ask, and I was from the Bay Area. So I grew up on the peninsula, 5 minutes from Stanford. Half my friend's parents worked in the Valley. So I was kind of swimming the wrong way to have started an internet company in Atlanta, having been from here anyway. And so Ask, you know, I spent 3 months integrating E-Tour into Ask from Atlanta. And then I got the luckiest thing that ever happened to me. And this is why E-Tour wound up becoming kind of a blur, because Ask then became my real startup in a way. Like I, and in fact, I would say that I made a mistake ultimately in feeling that it was mine, when really it wasn't. That's how attached I got to it. But the week that that acquisition happened, Ask hired a new president for their web division named Steve Berkowitz, who became my mentor. And so we hit it off. And by the end of that summer, he was going to pay me to move home. We had just had our first kid. My parents were still here. And so I looked at it as like, great, they'll pay to move me out, and if it doesn't work, because I really was not a big fan of Ask Jeeves at the time. I thought what everybody else did, I was not a fanboy, and I kind of ran into a lot of trouble when I first started because I shit-talked too much about it. But he liked me, and he moved me out as head of product, and actually it wasn't even overall product, it was the head of advertising products. So I kind of, you know, he wound up bringing me along. The two of us wound up kind of turning it around together. You know, he had a really, you know, really incredible way of of teaching about business. And so I want to be in there for what, 7 years? I mean, and the first three in product, then two as general manager of the Ask business, because we bought a couple other companies. And so Ask Jeeves Inc. sat across three companies and I ran one of them, which was Ask. So when I became CEO, actually technically it wasn't even a new job. It was just almost more of a different title for the same job. But that kept me going. You know, that whole time it was just like I was doing, Ask was my IPO ultimately, because it was 79 or 80 cents a share the day I joined. We got up to $45 a share by 2004. And so, you know, sold for over $2 billion. I mean, it was an incredible ride.
Let's talk about how you did that. And it kept doing well, and it survived even after the sale. Talk about the toughest area to be in. It's online search. Huge competition, lots of money at stake. Nobody's taking their eye off the ball even for a second, and you're in there competing with them. When you came in there, you were shit-talking them. Why? What did you see that was wrong with the product at the time?
I mean, right? Remember?
You'd ask it a question. Promise of answers. If you asked the question, it would give you the answer.
It was the exact opposite of Google, which, I mean, Ask overpromised and underdelivered. It said it would answer questions, and it didn't. And the reason it didn't is because it's extremely hard. It's the hardest problem to solve in search. It's why nobody does it, even today, at a high degree of, you know, high percentage of accuracy. And I mean, let alone in 1997, 98, I mean, give me a break. So then you had the crash, which had decimated the company and the morale of everybody there. You had rolling blackouts in California at the time, and so to like save money, the lights went off early. Literally the lights in the whole building would go off, and like Pavlov, like everybody would go home. And so even when the blackouts ended and the lights would come back on, everybody would go home. You'd almost reestablish this startup culture. They started charging for Cokes. So meanwhile, we're doing all this, we're not profitable, there's 17 ads on the page. And Google came along with real search that worked, no ads on the page. They only did search, which was still the number one user need online. Every one of its competition had taken its eye off the ball to become a portal. And so, you know, by the day I joined, I think Google already had 20 times as many searches as Ask. Now, what Ask did have was a brand, and it may have been one that people didn't like. It may have been the butt of a lot of jokes, but it was well known. And so it still had millions of users. And so we didn't have the money to invest in a lot of technology and a lot of people. And search advertising had not taken off yet. So we weren't going to get that revenue anytime soon. So we resolved simply to take the people who are already coming, give them a better service, so that today, if 17 out of 100 people liked what they got, tomorrow it would be 18, and then they would come back more often, and we would grow traffic that way. And so the day I left, that was always the strategy. I mean, even through times when we did television ads and things like that under Barry Diller, it was still that we never expected to beat Google or to be larger, but it was how much could we grow as a percentage of ourselves? And so everything we did over that period of time was dedicated at that. The first thing was that we bought a search engine, or I should say Steve did, because it was really an Ask thing and I was just part of his team, a search engine called Teoma in New Jersey, which was founded by a couple of Rutgers professors. And it was legit. I mean, it was a theory. It was only 7 to 10 people, but it was a legit search technology. And so Ask, I think, traded 10% of its market cap to this little startup, who they all wound up doing very well, and started building its own search engine. We decided the one thing that we can do is that people are already coming to us for search, so let's do search, get rid of everything else, and let's do it well. And so from that day, we got Teoma, we started building out what ultimately became over 200 people in Piscataway, New Jersey, and we started building search.
Where were your search results coming from before?
Well, technically, I don't think Ask had search at that point. So ironically, even though if you would look at the user data, even though it was known for questions, what people were using it for was search. And if you surveyed any user, they would actually tell you that links were answers. So in a way, what Google was already doing was already answering questions, right? So it wasn't our strategy was to do anything that they were doing. And even later on, some people said that we tried to become more like them. That wasn't true at all. We were trying to answer questions or more accurately searches, because people were being trained to type queries however they wanted to, not being forced to do it as a question. And so what we realized is you have to play defense, not offense. You can't tell people how to use a search engine. You have to let them use it the way they're going to use it, and then be on the other side of that search box waiting for them with the best answer or tools that can help them find the answer possible. And that could only be done after the query. If you try and force the user before the query through advanced search, toggling of any kind, you're hopeless.
Because how did you try to do that? Did you try to do it at any point by asking the beginning of the question to encourage them to form their search query as a question? Did you say over and over in different ways that that users need to ask questions? How'd you do it?
Ask had spent a lot of money and a lot of time. And they ultimately would have gone bankrupt if they hadn't figured out a way to do this right. Explaining to users that they needed to answer to ask it in the form of a question. It was like Jeopardy.
So you would just keep buying ads to say, this is the way you interact with our site.
By the time I got there, there was no money for ads. I mean, they weren't advertising anymore. But the brand was very, very well established. Jeeves was part of culture.
Yeah.
It was in Macy's Day Parade. People knew Ask Jeeves. And that turned out to be a great asset, again, no matter how negative that brand was. So what we said was, well, what can we do to answer these questions better? And so the first was try to let them ask it any way they want it. Don't force them into framing their question a certain way, because what it did was it added a step of work. It made them think. Horrible. So don't make them think. Let them ask it any way they want. And then answer it as best you can. The only way to at scale across billions of searches answer questions is with plain old search technology, because it's the only thing that's going to broadly bring back enough results that are accurate enough. Because I always say about search, a lot of people think they know how to build a search engine because they use search, because it's the number one thing that you use online. And that's like, to me, that's like people thinking they can write a screenplay because they watch movies or sitcoms. You know, it's actually, if you sit on the other side of the search box and you watch what comes through, first of all, it's disturbing. Second of all, it's extremely educational. Just like how crazy broad it is, how the same topic can be asked 100 different ways every single day, and how it changes based on, some things never change, like, how can I tell if I'm pregnant, or dictionary, you know, things like that. Other things like the oil spill and you know, whatever's happening today are going to change a lot. And so there's no way you can ever manually do it. There's no way that can ever prefabricate it.
That's right. 2 months ago, oil spill would have been maybe I spilled oil on my carpet. How do I clean it is the result I would look for. Yeah. Today, oil spill is a query that's oil spill is looking for information on the recent oil spill.
Right. And so we actually had to make a very tough decision because, we actually had to make the decision to be less differentiated, you know, which kind of goes against every fiber in my body in terms of branding, that it's exactly what people tell you not to do. But the truth is, it's the only reason we grew as much as we did after that, because we started answering what the people, you know, what people were asking. And if it would have been cutting off our nose to spite our face to try to simply differentiate from other search engines just to be different. And so the decision was we'd rather have a slice of a watermelon than a whole grape. And we'd rather And so even today, when Ask is kind of off the map and considered to be an also-ran, and it's still, if you looked at, they just released the Google Top 1000 sites, it was still 18th. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, just so, and it's because there's not that many branded destinations people know for search. And if you do a better job than you did yesterday, more people will come back tomorrow.
So how did you change? And it would be, you were asking people for questions, and if they typed in a question, where would the results come from? And what were those results?
I mean, the day I got originally, there, the thing at the top, well, so first of all, one of the best things Steve Berkowitz taught me was about being obsessive with data. And we, luckily, one of the things that Ask had done, by the way, there were so many talented, smart, good people who had been through Ask or were still at Ask. And what was great is it was the people who cared the most. I think it had gone from 800 people down to 250 people when I got there. But, you know, Peter Norvig, who wound up becoming, you know, the head of relevance at Google, had been through Ask. I mean, all kinds of very, very good people had touched this. But the first thing you would get was called the knowledge base. And that was the prefabricated kind of, you know, hand matching answers to your question. So that if you would say, you know, is it raining in Seattle, there would be an answer there. It turned out that would match 85% of the time.
Wow.
First thing on the page, and it would only be picked on 25% of the time. So you're just shooting yourself in the mouth. I mean, when you do that to your site, it's just
why? Death. I've just asked you what the temperature is in Seattle. You've told me the answer. I'm not clicking why.
We've only told you the answer basically one out of five times.
But right? I thought it was an 85% result rate. 85% of the time,
no,
you had the answer.
Match rate. It would come up 85% of the time, but it would only be picked on 25% of the time.
Yeah. Why wasn't it picked on more?
Why wasn't it? Because it wasn't accurate. Because if you're if you're trying to hand match these things to billions of queries, you're going to start stretching the system, and it would come up when it shouldn't. Now, partly it would come up when it shouldn't because of failures in technology. Partly it came up when it shouldn't because the company was married to its original concept. And so the question was, how can we get the 25% matching to 27, where honestly, you know, what we wound up seeing was that if you just replace that with regular search results, even Taoma day one, which was not a very good search engine when we got it, that click-through rate went up to like, it matched 90% of the time and it was picked on 80% of the time. Right? So in that first year, we increased traffic like 40, 50%, I think, from where it was. And that was just based on the people coming back more often.
Okay, that's a tough, that's more than a pivot. That's a big change. And it's a tough one to make. How did you guys come to that decision that you were going to change the business that dramatically? Was there a champion inside who said, we have to do this? Were there conversations that you can tell us a little bit about?
Yeah, I mean, there were multiple. Well, so I'd say at the end of the day, the person most responsible is Steve Berkowitz, because myself, Paul Gardy, who is the head of Taoma, several other people, we saw this and were pushing to kind of dump that knowledge base and go with more search-oriented products that were proprietary, that we could own, that we saw the data on, as opposed to outsourcing it. One of the ideas was outsourcers to Ink2Me or Google or somebody. But we said, look, we went to the board, which included the founder of Ask Jeeves, and we said, we want to take this in a completely different direction. And it was a lot of arm wrestling. I mean, it was very painful. I always would say I had a lot of arrows in my back from pushing so hard against the historical product of Ask.
So how did you convince them? I'm going to have a situation in my life, and everyone listening to us is going to have one in their lives, where they're convinced that they need to make a drastic change, but they have to convince others in order to make that change. How did you do it?
Data is the only way. So we owned Taoma already at that point. We'd already put them in there. A-B testing, you know, but in 2001, A-B testing wasn't that common. I mean, it was, and we just did a crap load of it. And every click, every breath a user took on our site, we measured everything. We had a data warehouse that we called What's Up, which really dates us because that was from the Budweiser commercials, where every morning Steve and I would get in and our offices were next to each other and we'd go online and we'd start shouting at each other, like, why was the click-through rate on this product down 0.1% during between 3 and 4 p.m. yesterday? And you just start analyzing it and seeing, and then you would test other configurations. And by the way, this wound up also changing us from a revenue point of view, because what we also proved to ourselves was that there's only one click that you can get on any page, so make it the most valuable click it could be. And that you'd rather, and ironically, you could, by having fewer ads on the page, you could make more money because you would drive the clicks into the things that were the most valuable. We had Overture at the time. And it was amazing to see higher RPMs by having fewer ads. And things like, if you got rid of this banner, the results get moved up the page. That increases the click-through rates, both on your regular results and on the search ads. That increases loyalty. You measure that over 6 months. You see that after 6 months, loyalty is now, you've now broken even on getting on the money that you would have made through those ads, and you're now getting more users back. And that's the gift that keeps on giving. And so all those kinds of decisions are made with data. And at the end of the day, whether it was the Ask board in 2001, trusting us to go in a new direction with the product, or it was Barry Diller, when he acquired us, letting us go from having 10 ads above our search results, which we had to do as a public company, and we can talk about how we got into that, because that was a misreading of data in some ways that led us to think that that was good for the business. But once you went to 10 ads above the results, you could never go back, because now you have to keep making quarterly numbers. And so Barry trusted us that we did 8 months of research that said that if we went from 10 ads to 3, that it would take us X amount of time to break even. And then in 2006, we grew 50%, you know, after we got rid of those 10 ads. And Barry trusted us. So I guess, I don't know, we had a good way of telling people to trust us, but we always had data that would tell you, you know, you'd be okay if you did it.
What was the misreading of data that ended up, that caused you guys to have 10 ads on top of search results?
Well, it was both misreading and it was going back to your drug analogy, it was heroin, where, you know, I think one, I can't remember what it was, but the long story short, we went down to just search ads. Overture made that market. They should get all the credit in the world for it. People now, you know, Victor's rewrite, you know, write history, but it wasn't Google, it was Overture. Google copied Overture. They did it in a unique way, but for the most part, it was Overture. And then in 2002, we switched to Google, and there were two reasons. Overture was very mad. One was Google was making this product for themselves. So to give it to us, as long as they were making a dollar, and it was just an XML feed of their ads, they could do it. So they could give us such a high revenue share that Overture, which had no proprietary traffic, they had to pass those costs on to their partners. So it just wasn't even close. Besides that, Google broad matched their search terms, and it took Overture a while to catch up to this. They were, you know, they had better relevance, but Google had made you more money because their ads would just match even times when they shouldn't. And so those two things meant that Google's revenue per thousand searches were so lucrative that within one quarter of switching to them in 2002, Ask had its first profitable quarter ever in Q4 of 2002. And that started our stock going. So while I'd like to take credit for all of it, and I'm sure our team back then would, and you know, I think we all had a big impact on the product side. Really, the search market was so hot and made us all so much money that I'd say that was at least half of what made us perceived to be such a great turnaround, right? Luckily for us, we had the brand, we had the traffic. Now, a year later, when your year-over-year comps start slowing down, well, you know, you're not going to have the double impact of traffic growth and incredible revenue, RPM growth. So now you have to start twisting dials to make your numbers, you know, what they need to be when you're public. Google right now, you'll never really see when they're doing this, but they have every knob that they ever want to turn, change the font sizes, change the shading of the ads from blue to yellow, back to light blue. There's so many things that you can do, especially when they have a network the way that they have it. For Ask, which did not have that footprint, we had our own website mostly that we could deal with. And so we started adding more ads on the page. It wasn't on every query, it was like maybe sometimes. And then as you go, you start thinking, you know, we could stomach this on 5% of all queries, having 10 ads. Well, it turned out it was more than 5%. I mean, it wound up being 15%. And then a year later, as Google grew its business and they got more and more and more companies advertising, that 15% grew to 30%. It was every commercial query. And it is a fact that every click into an ad is at the detriment, not every click, 4 to 5 clicks, in my opinion.
4 out of 5 clicks on an ad,
Result negatively on user loyalty. Because it textually matches, but when you get to the page, it rarely is what you were actually looking for. Because they're saying, you know, it's because it's targeting running shoes doesn't mean that you wanted to buy them on the spot at that moment. Anyway, so that's why later, I mean, that's why we knew this. That's why we A-B tested ourselves to death trying to figure out how we could get out of the death spiral of having so many ads. And to Barry Diller's credit, he trusted us, and we had our best year ever in 2006.
Now, a couple of years ago, I read on blogs that those ads were coming back, that you guys went from 2 ads to 3 ads and that there were more and more. Why?
I mean, it's... I think a lot of the same reasons. It's just something that, you know, I think there's a lot of private conversations that I probably, you know, I'll leave that to be corporate business. But long story short, what I would just say is every lesson that we had historically was not wrong. And so if you want to turn that dial, then there's consequences for the user experience. If there's consequences for the user experience, going back through the history of the web, you can see that there's a penalty to pay with users.
How do you get more users in search? I saw the ads that you guys were doing on TV, the It's the Algorithm ad, and I think I saw some ads online. What do you do to grow search?
Well, so the most important thing over that time was the thing least written about, least understood, and it was just that we innovated our asses off. I mean, we were very well respected, even when we were asked Jeeves during that period among the people at the core of search, starting to their credit with Danny Sullivan, Chris Sherman, Gary Price, Barry Schwartz, the people at the heart of the search industry. They didn't have biases against us, at least after we started proving ourselves. John Battelle is another one, where they took our innovation at face value, and we were very early in many of the things that then became standard in search. Whether it was saving search results, this thing called My Jeeves at the time, which was very forward-looking, related search, we were the first ones to actually put it on the page.
Search types.
Things that we called, yeah, things that we could, right, exactly, type ahead. Things called that we called smart answers, which were hearkening back to the knowledge base that didn't work, but now it did work, and we restricted the matching to only when it was appropriate, and then the click-through rate was insanely high, which Google, it became Google One Box. Even today, like, we were the first ones to change the homepage the way Bing and Google now have, to having images, pretty background images, you know, which is cheesy, but it, like, people liked it. And we were scrappy. I mean, we were the fourth place search engine. It was our place to innovate our way from where we were. And, you know, the most gratifying thing was Walt Mossberg twice within 1 year wrote full column ad or articles that were basically ads for Ask, saying that we were awesome. And, you know, mistakenly I thought that would make us. But a big thing started happening online in 2005, 2006, which was the blogosphere, social. People's attention just started getting very dispersed, and so one article couldn't make you anymore the way it could 5 years earlier. In fact, no articles wound up having the impact that they had 5 years earlier. And that still exists today. I mean, it takes massive word of mouth volume and consistency over time to build any brand online. But luckily at the time, we couldn't afford to do TV ads or anything like that. So user loyalty was how we improved originally. Then we could afford to do advertising, but we couldn't afford to do very much. And so we actually experimented ourselves with TV ads, but they were very descriptive. They were just reintroduction of the brand to people. You know, ask Jeeves how would I call it the long orbit, which is we touched almost everybody online. It's just that instead of once a day or once a week, it was once every 3 months. It was when you had a question. So even loyalty would take us a lot of time to get to everybody because they didn't come back as often. But what we found was if you stoked people's awareness of Ask, they would come back once a month. And then we had the opportunity to show them the new site. So TV ads were actually profitable for Ask when we did them affordably, cheaply, and descriptively. We saw this even in 2006. We did ads that honestly just showed our page and what was different about it. So those all worked. And I would argue that we were in a unique position with our brand to do those ads. Most people are not. It's not a good brand introduction. Except maybe Hulu. Hulu maybe was a good example, one that was. Now, interestingly, Hulu had the same ad agency that we did for the algorithm. Big, expensive, over the top. And it just didn't work. I mean, it was a company-wide IC Ask decision. I was definitely part of it to experiment with some much more dramatic and creative ads. Barry, to his credit, believed so much in our product that he wanted the world to know about it. And it just was a shitty campaign. I mean, there's no other way to put it. I mean, it just wasn't very good. And in a way, it made us seem bratty. You know, I think we may have gone from being the kid in the back of the class everybody rooted for to the one that people thought was, you know, was snotty. And I think that's a fine line. You know, people were starting to root for us in the search industry, and then all of a sudden they're like, what are they doing? But they never did that when we ran other TV ads, just these ads. So anyway, by the end of the year, we were back to running these ones that literally just showed people using our website in little, you know, we had our highest traffic quarter ever in Q4 2007.
Is there a way to add viral marketing to search?
No, I'd say viral marketing and search is word of mouth. And to that extent, I think, you know, again, so many things get tried over and over again. And I always like to say, just because something's new to you doesn't make it new. And so many people kind of went through these search companies that you get new blood in and they go back to trying the same old things. You know, like Microsoft just tried cashback with Bing and that didn't work.
Didn't you guys do that too before?
No, Ask.
No, someone did.
Didn't do it. Okay. But there were businesses. There was a company called Blingo that did it. They sold to Columbia House maybe or whatever that pub. Yeah, Columbia House.
I don't remember.
You know, it's interesting. I've thought a lot about this, and I think, again, the misperception of Ask and the misjudgment of Ask would have been to say that it was a failure if it didn't get more traffic than Google and Yahoo, right? When it was starting from a base of, let's say, 10 million users going to 20 or 30, as opposed to 400 million users or where Google was even when I got there, which was the biggest brand in the world. You know, at the time, you had never, now Facebook and Twitter have gotten some of this, but you had never seen anything like what had happened to their brand, where every television show was talking about them and every news channel was talking about them. So it was an incredible kind of headwind to walk into. So what I always try to focus our team on was measure us versus ourselves. Measure us versus last week, last month, last year, not only against these other guys, especially because then we're going to start trying to copy them and that's not going to take you anywhere good. Focus on our users, focus on innovating, focus on the data. But what I want to say about viral, I'll wrap up, but what I want to say about viral is with search, Google has such a large, talented team on search, and they have the killer app for search, which is traffic. They see all the queries. They can apply technology that improves the queries through machine learning, just through their own users' usage of their site, which also is what we were doing, but they could do it at massive scale beyond us. That it's and users never became so sophisticated that they wanted a different way of searching. I mean, it was kind of default that no matter what you tried to do, the majority of the time when they search, they're under duress, they want to get something done, they want to get it done right now. They're not going to think about, you know, some feature that you may have that's different. They're not going to think about, you know, it's going to be what do they think works. And actually, even worse, it may be what's good enough that they trust it will work versus the risk that the upside of ask, for example, is worth the downside of not getting what they want before they have to get back to check on their baby to, you know, this recipe that they were looking up. So it's a very hard place to move. I'm not going to say Google had checkmate on people. But even from a design point of view, white space with nothing else in the way, if you just do that, you're just copying them.
Right.
Right?
Right.
But it's what users want.
Yeah.
So what do you do? So you make a decision of, do you just do something different just to do that? Or do you give your users what they want, even if it's more similar to what other people are doing?
Let me ask one other question about ask, and then I've got to come back to Clicker. One of my viewers is Gabriel Weinberg, guy's creating DuckDuckGo.com. Do you know that search engine?
Yeah.
Do you have any advice for him?
I think two things. One is, whatever he's doing from a brand point of view, it's appealing to certain people, and I love that. I mean, one thing I love that he did was with privacy. So right before I left Ask, we decided that we kind of saw where the market was going on privacy, and we said, look, everybody's going to regulate the shit out of us if we don't regulate ourselves. So we're going to draw a line in the sand here. We're going to say we're only going to keep user data. I can't remember now, but whatever it was like a third as long as other search engines, and it was whatever the European Union, because 40% of my revenue was UK-based, whatever the European Union said was mandatory. And then we you know, went deep on broadcasting the fact that we were doing this. Now, DuckDuckGo has done that. And I think that they're making headway with being the place that doesn't try to record what you're doing. Now, again, I don't know if that's enough to overcome the good enough problem under duress, but I think if it's a way to become default for a certain number of people, that's great. And the great thing about search is you don't have to be a big search engine to make a lot of money. The revenue is so powerful in search that, you know, again, I think you can be very misleading to call it a Google killer. I mean, Teoma, when we first bought it in 2001, I learned very quickly that this Google killer thing is not, it's not that fruitful. We were on CNN as a Google killer with Teoma. You couldn't even pronounce it or spell it. And the press loves that story, but people don't buy it. I think it's got to be feature based, quality based, and and I would be sticking to it.
Okay, all right. So I have a note here to come back to UI on Clicker. What do you do for UI? Do you do listening labs? Are you watching people? How are you tracking clicks online? What are you doing?
It's really, for us, it's a very creative whittling process. So first of all, we know at the core we have a plan. So I like to kind of think of my strategy for team building as kind of like the A-team. So if that makes me Hannibal, that's not the new A-team, which looks like it'll suck, but the real A-team. But you have these guys who are just really, really good at certain things. They've proven themselves over time. And that's your team, and you, that core team for me has been together now a long time, and they're here with me at Clicker, and so we knew that for the user they needed this presented in a more directory or taxonomy like format. We knew that with video things had to be very visual, And we knew that we were going to have information overload even on our own pages to do this right. So our site will never be the cleanest from the standpoint that there's a ton of metadata around every one of these shows and episodes that's important to the user, and we're going to be very data rich. And so then it just went to 15 different ways of designing. The good news for us is we had a year to do it because it took so long to do the search technology to get all the data in the first place that we had time to get it right. I don't like Usability Lab because the problem is people are being paid to be there. It's one person being interviewed by another one person. And what I discovered in 2009 was a website called usertesting.com, which I love. And if I was an investor, I would have invested in and put as much juice behind it as possible, because for now $25 a person, I can have them use my website under password protection. I can target it by country, by age, by browser type, and I can then watch them screencast themselves using my site. And what you'll find when people are alone in their homes is they're brutally honest. They will tell you what they really think. And so whether features are confusing, whether you look too much like somebody else, or they think this is better than somebody else, you hear it. And so, I don't know, we may have made 400 tweaks to the website between the first beta and when we launched, based on feedback that we got through user testing.
I see. So and that's how... Sorry, you go ahead.
Well, no, and then I was going to say, then we had a two-month official beta period where we had close to 50,000 people after TechCrunch on the site using it, and even the site that we launched to everybody in November was not the same site exactly that we had in September.
So now I think I understand how, with a long period of time where the average person couldn't come on your website, you were still collecting user data because you were using services like usertesting.com to watch people and to see how they were interacting and get their feedback.
Oh, you know, we had one other thing, by the way, which is that when we get funded, we actually, Bill Gurley, my main investor, had found a little company in LA that may be similar to Utour, wasn't the best situation, that we could subsume as part of my funding and take them in-house. So that's why I was commuting to LA for these 18 months. What I decided was, for acceleration, for momentum, I would just keep them down there, and my team and I would just fly down every week for 3 days a week. I have three kids, so that let me kind of have some white space to be creative and think 3 days a week without obligations of home. And so we had a little bit of data. They weren't used very much, but we had a little bit of data from their website, which they had kind of false started a couple times, but was out there to kind of learn at least some initial live user things. So that helped as well.
What was that company?
Modern Feed.
I'm sorry, we lost the connection. Can you say it again, please?
It's called Modern Feed.
Modern Feed.
The founder grew up on a farm in Wisconsin, and the name was inspired by that. But so once we officially launched, we redirected the site to clicker.com. But you know, I'd say by the end of the day, it was less than 5% of our final product, but the spirit of it was similar. And so anyway, that was just more data that we could have.
Why are you sending users away from your site instead of having all the videos play within your website?
Well, I feel like, first of all, we had to make a choice, which was that, in my opinion, you either need to be TV or TV Guide, and you can't be both. If you're to do TV Guide right, and again, I'm using them figuratively, not literally, but to be that programming guide for the next generation of TV, we felt that you needed to be three things: comprehensive, unbiased, and structured, you know, organized. You had to be able to surf it in a taxonomy, not just through search, because most of the time you don't know exactly what you're looking for. And so to be comprehensive, you would need to include things that you couldn't host on your own site. To be unbiased, you needed to do the same. And then to be a search engine, you have to be unbiased. You can't be sending people to the shows you prefer, and then you can't be in competition with the people who you're trying to send traffic to. If I was hosting all this stuff, then you know, I would be biased against your show. My job is to let people know everything about Mixergy that they need to know, that it exists, an episode guide, and then I need to, if you want to give us an embed, we'll have it. Because, and especially down the mid-tail, sites want that because it's good for brand awareness. They more want to go where the user is. For the majority of network sites, they don't want that. They want to protect their traffic. And that's great. So we kind of do both, but our we don't have a point of view that says we need to host it on our site.
I think you said to Beat.tv that revenue, or BTV, that the revenue was going to come from advertising. And did you say lead gen also?
Yeah, so I mean, this can evolve, right? Because we're still pre-revenue mostly. I mean, we get paid for some lead gen right now, like to a Netflix or iTunes. And I think it's a good example of where we're not biased. Like, we don't promote them in the UI, but it's that if we send people through, we can get paid. And if you look at all the subscription services that are now going to be launching, it's happening. I mean, you're going to see more and more and more of these subscription services as a way to make money when they're not going to make it as much through advertising. Apps are another good example of this, and we think it's almost the same thing, that you know, we can make money by sending people to apps. And so it's very much like search.
I see.
Eventually, we could also have search ads targeted against shows. So if it's a mom show, we could have another mom show targeted. Or if it's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, you know, Modern Family, when it first started, may have wanted to be targeted against that. Or you, if for some reason you're getting $50 CPMs or something, and people are paying to subscribe, you want to target against This Week in Startups or something else, you know. So we want to enable that. I'm from search. My CTO is from Overture. I mean, we have this in our blood, and it's a very, very good model.
All right, one other question that a few people kept saying in the audience, they kept saying, ask him about Boxy. Ask him about Boxy. So how do you fit in into the space with Boxy?
Well, we started as partners. I mean, I think we are very compatible in a number of ways. And then, like everything in this space, nobody does exactly what we do, but we all overlap with each other a little bit. And I think it's just because it's like search in the early days. It's Wild West still. And so everyone's trying to, you know, figure out where they fit. We launched a Boxy app in December. I was actually on stage with Abner in Brooklyn at their Boxy Palooza event. and so we were one of the first apps on Boxy beta. And so we still are. I mean, we're still featured on the homepage. The way I would think about it is that they're an operating system. They're a downloadable application, browser. They cover things that we would never cover, like things on your hard drive. Well, maybe not never, but things that we don't cover and probably won't cover, like things on your hard drive. They link to apps like music. And because it's an operating system for you, your PC on your TV, whereas we are a pencil. We do one thing. We're TV Guide for internet TV. And so we index, you know, whatever, 500% more content than they have with deals for things in their site. Now, Clicker.tv, which just launched, was not launched to be a competitor to Boxy, but as a pure web destination, it has a lot of the same characteristics in terms of being a navigable with a remote version of Clicker. It was inspired by our Boxy app, and then it's going to inspire our iPad app. So I'd say that's it, and we're good friends with them, and we had the same PR agency and for a long time, and we're, you know, I think we'll keep partnering. I mean, Abner says he wants Clicker.tv on Boxy, so we'll figure out how to make that happen.
Right. Well, cool. I see that we've already gone over our time, and I didn't even get to ask you about the advisory work you did with CNET, with Aardvark, where you were an early investor. Congratulations on that. Ustream, I got a whole bunch of other stuff, but maybe we'll do another interview. Thank you for doing this interview.
All right, Andrew.